Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Military History. This is your host, Bob Wintermute. One of the great gray areas of First World War historiography deals with the African-American experience. Even as the war was drawing to a close, white historians, participants, and politicians sought to limit the record of the participation of black soldiers, while also seeking to recast the standard narrative of the war as a white American crusade against German militarism. As a result of this, the rich experience of the African American community and their participation in the war was lost and hidden away from public view. While there have been some efforts since the end of the war to restore this history to its rightful place, until recently, all too many of these accounts have focused on specific units, individuals, or events, often written by well-meaning amateurs driven by their own zeal to correct injustice and set the record straight. Many of these accounts miss the mark in creating a solid historical narrative. This is not the case with Chad Williams' new book, Torchbearers of Democracy, African American Soldiers in the World War I Era. We'll be talking with Chad about his book and reviewing the extensive archival research and the painstakingly constructed narrative, balanced with his own insights as to how the First World War and the immediate post-war period should be reconsidered as the founding point of the modern civil rights movement. Hello, Chad.
Hey, how's it going?
Very good. Today we're talking with Chad Williams about his new book, Torchbearers of Democracy, African American Soldiers in the World War I Era. I've read his book and I can highly recommend it. It is part of a recent trend in American military history in that it's dedicated to restoring the voice of the African American community and their sacrifices, contributions, and struggles for respect and equality during the First World War. Chad's making a great contribution to the story through his painstakingly constructed narrative approach, but he also has much to offer in terms of understanding the delicate balance between obligation, duty, and honor on the part of black soldiers and rejection, racism, and inequality on the part of white society in the United States and abroad during the war. Chad, would you mind telling us a bit about yourself and what motivated you to pursue the project?
Sure. Well, I went to graduate school initially planning to study the Civil War and Reconstruction. And as I began to read more and more about early 20th century American history, and specifically the World War I era, began to get more and more interested in that particular time period, and specifically the place of African Americans during the World War I era. I was struck by the void in historical scholarship on African Americans during the war, and more specifically, the experiences of African American soldiers. And I saw this as an opportunity to really examine what I view as a critical period in American history and in African American history, more specifically, through the experiences of African-American soldiers. It's still a period which I'm pleased that a lot of historians are now gravitating towards, but obviously a lot more work needs to be done in really exploring the complexities of this particular time period.
Clearly. I mean, especially with such an important period that's been overlooked for so long.
Exactly.
You position the First World War really as a turning point for African Americans in their quest for legitimacy and equality in American society. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think it was absolutely a critical moment, particularly in the context of early 20th century America. I really frame how African Americans approached the war and specifically the meanings of military service in relation to the Civil War and also the experiences of black soldiers in the regular army in the late 19th and early 20th century, where the questions of citizenship and obligation, the relationship between race and democracy were very much unsettled. This was a period in time when the gains of the Civil War and Reconstruction had been largely swept away through various discriminatory measures, legal as well as informal segregation, racial violence. So African Americans approach World War I as an opportunity to really bring effective meaning to democracy as both an ideal but also as a relationship with the state in terms of citizenship rights and opportunities for the expansion of a notion of democracy in which African Americans were really struggling to make a reality. So I definitely see this as a crucial moment in which African Americans began to forge different opportunities, different strategies for expanding their place in American democracy within the context of the war and through the complexities with the opportunities but also the limitations of serving in the nation's military.
Okay. What was the Army's general position on African Americans in 1917? We know, of course, that there were the four colored regiments,
right,
but there was also the specter of Brownsville and Houston.
Right, right. Well, the as you said, the Army did have the long-established Buffalo Soldier regiments, the 24th and 25th Infantry and the 9th and 10th Cavalry regiments. So there was a place for African-American soldiers in the Army leading up to World War I. But this was, of course, highly problematic, specifically because, as you mentioned, there had been a long history, both long as well as recent, racial tensions between African-American soldiers in the regular Army and white Americans, particularly in the South and in the Southwest, in Texas, along the Mexican border, where racial clashes such as Brownsville and the more explosive Houston Rebellion, as I describe it in August of 1917, raised a really palpable sense of fear amongst many white Southerners, but also within the War Department about how best to use African-American soldiers in the war, if they should be used at all. And if so, in what capacity? Would they be trained in the South? Would they be allowed to serve in combat units? Who would command them? Would there be a place for African-American officers? So these kind of long-standing historical anxieties surrounding African-American soldiers and their place in the Army, which really goes back to the Civil War and the early days of Reconstruction, reverberated during the mobilization process in 1917 concerning the expansion of the American Army and the place of African American soldiers in the wartime Army.
I see. Was there resistance within the black community towards participation in the war effort?
There was some, absolutely. And I think this oftentimes doesn't get recognized, fully enough. I mean, you have a number of African Americans, particularly in the South, who were simply apathetic about serving in the military, but also apathetic about the war more broadly, did not see it as relevant to their everyday lives. Obviously, the challenges of being Black in the United States during this time, particularly in the South, weighed heavy on the minds of many African Americans. So fighting a war for these vague notions of democracy and freedom did not resonate for many African Americans. And they approached the war very apathetically, were not interested in fighting. You have a number, really a smaller number, of more highly politicized African Americans, particularly on the radical left associated with the Socialist Party, who were explicitly opposed to the war on political and ideological grounds, and felt that the United States had no business making the world safe for democracy, to invoke Woodrow Wilson's famous phrase, until democracy was made safe for African Americans at home. So you do have strains of resistance and opposition amongst African Americans that took various forms and was articulated in different ways.
I see. How did racial ideology affect the training and organization of Black soldiers during the war?
Well, the training of Black soldiers during the war was a highly contentious question, and it was shaped by what at the time was described as the race problem or the race question. And this translated into the question or the problem of African American soldiers in the wartime army, as I said, stemming from the Houston Rebellion in August 1917, which occurred really shortly after the establishment of the Selective Service system, just to what extent African American soldiers were going to be incorporated into the draft, in what capacity they were going to serve, where they would train, who would command them. These were all questions that the War Department and the Army struggled with really throughout the duration of the war. So race and racial ideologies really played a central role in the policies that the War Department created, and really their inability to formulate a kind of coherent system for organizing and mobilizing African American soldiers. The vast majority of Black troops served in a labor capacity. They were not assigned to combat units, which also reflected a prevailing racial ideology on the part of war planners that Black men, particularly from the South, were inherently suited and more naturally suited to serve in the labor capacity, that they did not have the necessary qualities to be effective combat soldiers, particularly on the Western Front in France. So for that reason, as well as a host of other reasons, the overwhelming majority of Black soldiers serve in the services of supply, as stevedores, as ditch diggers, as burying dead bodies, a whole assortment of other very unglamorous duties, both domestically and overseas as well.
Essential.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Essential but menial tasks.
Absolutely. And this is really something that African American soldiers themselves struggled with, but also something that African American social and political activists struggled with as well. Right? There was a intense desire on the part of individuals like W.B. Du Bois, a whole host of newspaper editors, a number of different male and female political activists across the ideological spectrum to use the war and the participation of Black soldiers in it as an opportunity to expand the possibilities of African American citizenship rights and inclusion in the democratic process in the United States and serving in the Army, but specifically fighting in the Army, you know, fighting on the front lines was seen as crucial to doing that, you know, for African-American soldiers to demonstrate their worth as Americans by sacrificing or shedding blood on the behalf of the nation. So the fact that the vast majority of black servicemen did not get that opportunity, that they were forced to serve in a labor capacity, was highly contradictory in many ways and was difficult to reconcile for obviously black soldiers who were experiencing, you know, these different types of discriminatory policies, but also on the part of their advocates as well.
Okay. Yeah, related to that, much has been made of how the French in particular welcomed African-American troops who were rejected by the American Expeditionary Force.
Right.
Is this an accurate portrayal?
To an extent. historians always like to qualify things. The War Department established two African-American combat divisions, the 92nd Division, which was made up of drafted black men, served in the American Expeditionary Forces. The second black combat division, the 93rd Division, was made up primarily of African-American National Guardsmen. It had one regiment of black draftees. But the 93rd Division was quite literally given over to the French Army and served throughout the duration of the war as part of the French forces. So in some ways, they had a much better experience than their counterparts in the 92nd Division because the French were more receptive to their presence, were more experienced, I might say, in dealing with soldiers of African descent based on their use of their own colonial soldiers, really from the outset of the war in 1914. And without question, I think France did approach race from a different perspective than many white Americans did. But this this isn't to say that France was completely colorblind. I think it would be a fallacy to make that argument. France had its own race problems in terms of dealing with their colonial subjects from North and West Africa. And they also viewed African-American soldiers through a highly romanticized and we might even say exoticized lens, kind of viewing the presence of African-Americans, particularly in terms of their cultural aesthetic, as kind of these exotic racial others. So there was definitely a strong presence of racial ideology in how the French were viewing African-American soldiers.
Okay. What about the actual combat performance for African-Americans in the trenches between comparing the two divisions?
Well, the 93rd Division, because it did serve with the French Army, had many more opportunities to fight on the front lines than the 92nd Division did. The French Army was desperate for troops by 1918 and were happy to get whatever help that they could receive. So soldiers of the 93rd Division were thrown into the trenches relatively quickly following their incorporation into the French Army. For example, the 369th Infantry Regiment, probably the most famous black infantry regiment of the war, that would become known as the Harlem Hellfighters, served for 191 days straight on the front lines without ceding any territory to the German Army. So they had a much more extensive combat experience and were decorated accordingly. Many of the most of the regiments of the 93rd Division and many individuals, such as Henry Johnson, for example, who fought with the 369th Infantry Regiment, was along with Needham Roberts, the first two American soldiers to receive the Croix de Guerre, the French War Cross. So their contributions, their exploits, were recognized by the French army. That was a very important part of how the war was seen and used by African Americans at home as an example of why African Americans deserved increased citizenship rights. Conversely, the 92nd Division had a much more contentious experience. They had to deal with the full brunt of institutionalized racism within the Army, a really pervasive sense on the part of many white military officials that black soldiers were not capable of being effective soldiers, that black officers who were commissioned and assigned to the 92nd Division were not effective leaders, did not have the intellectual capability to be effective officers. So all of these assumptions and the sheer weight of institutionalized racism within the 92nd Division really curtailed the opportunities but also the performance of the 92nd Division, particularly in the Meuse-Argonne offensive in the fall of 1918, where one of the black regiments of the 92nd Division had a very trying experience and, in fact, colored how the entire division and black combat soldiers more broadly were viewed after the war, being seen as failures, black officers being viewed as incompetent. So the memory of the 92nd Division being perceived as a failure has been really very powerful, and in one of the one of my goals in my book and kind of retelling the story is to complicate that memory, that legacy.
Well, I mean, that's an important objective, particularly in view of the legacy of these two experiences and how the 92nd Division's memory seems to outlast or survive that of the 93rd until recent times.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sorry, I was going to ask if you could comment briefly on the 1925 Army War College report and how that represents this legacy.
Yeah, in some ways that's directly informed by the perceived failures of the 92nd Division and specifically the failures during the Meuse-Argonne offensive. And that was a report that had significant implications for how the post-war Army would be organized and the opportunities that would be afforded to African American soldiers and officers as well, really directly out of the kind of contentious memories of black participation in the First World War, and really reflects how, on the one hand, you have an official narrative that is coming out of the War Department positing that black soldiers were failures, made no lasting contributions to the war, that the experiment in black officers could not be repeated in the peacetime army. And at the same time, an effort on the part of African Americans, both historians, but also different types of artists, veterans themselves, to push against this idea that black soldiers didn't have any meaningful contribution to the war, right? So you have a counter memory that's being propagated by African Americans to demonstrate in a wide variety of different forms and venues and manifestations that black experience in the war was something that was meaningful and something that the nation as a whole should be proud of.
Aside from the issue of combat performance and suitability, how did Jim Crow follow black soldiers to France?
Well, in some ways it followed them like a shadow. I mean, it was inescapable in many regards, particularly for the servicemen who were incorporated into the American Expeditionary Forces, both as combatants, but also as as laborers as well. You mentioned the preponderance of black servicemen in the services of supply. So they served in completely segregated units. Their social services were segregated as well. This led to inferior treatment, quality of services. For example, the YMCA was highly discriminatory in terms of many of their practices towards African-American troops. It was France was in some ways a racial battleground because of the presence of Jim Crow, American-style white supremacy being transplanted from the United States to French soil. You have a hysteria that grips many white military officials that black servicemen are going to rape white French women, which is directly pulled from the fears of rape and the sexual anxieties surrounding black men in the South, which contributed to the horrors of lynching and racial violence in the American South. So many of these racial fears and anxieties are being transplanted to French soil, which in some ways, going back to one of your earlier questions, shapes how African Americans viewed their French counterparts. In some ways, this trope of French racial egalitarianism came about because of the juxtaposition between how virulent racism was as practiced by white military officials and ordinary white soldiers versus how French officers and soldiers and civilians as well did not treat African-American soldiers in that type of way. Not to say that the French were colorblind, but that the racism that they experienced amongst the French was nowhere near as vicious as it was what they experienced from their fellow white Americans.
It's a great tragedy, of course. Well, what about the German perspective? Is there any record of that?
There are some. I mean, there's some really fascinating anecdotes of Germans becoming aware of the soldiers who they were fighting against on the other side of the lines being African-American soldiers. And their efforts to propagandize amongst black troops, telling them that, why are you fighting for the United States? You're being discriminated against. You should throw down your arms and fight with Germany where you'll be treated equally. Of course, this was preposterous. But it does kind of speak to a certain racial awareness on the part of the German forces and their ability to try and take advantage of the racial dynamics within the United States and use that to their advantage. Obviously, kind of fast forwarding to the immediate post-war period and the response of Germany to the occupation of the Rhineland on the part of the French army, how they used African soldiers to occupy the Rhine, and the kind of intense racial response on the part of the German people to that occupation kind of speaks to kind of their kind of deep-seated racial anxieties and notions of white supremacy. So you get that played out in terms of some of the interactions between African American and German troops as well. But I think one of the most interesting things is how the German army tried to use America's racism and really the racism practiced by Great Britain as well to their advantage.
Let's turn back to this side of the Atlantic. How high were African American hopes for change at the war's end?
Well, I think, and this is a really important question, and I would argue that they were, in fact, very high. And part of the historiography that I try and challenge in my book is the sense that as soon as the war came to an end, that there was this deep powerful disillusionment that set in amongst African Americans, that their hopes for change were immediately dashed, that they essentially did not get anything out of the war. And I think if you look at the period immediately after the war, as African American troops are demobilizing, as they're returning back to the United States, they're turning back to their communities, both North and South, there is a tremendous sense of hope and optimism that their sacrifices, that their contributions have been worthwhile. You see this in a number of different forms, in African American newspapers, in the homecoming parades, in New York, Chicago, but also in communities throughout the South as well. A really palpable sense of optimism, of hope on the part of African Americans and among African American soldiers as well, that perhaps, you know, something was going to change, that this was the moment where the nation would recognize the contributions that Black people had made in the context of the war, and these, you know, very powerful notions of democracy and self-determination that Woodrow Wilson and others were propagating. So I think it's important to recognize that this was a moment where the hope of democracy, as I characterize it, was very real.
And we know the outcome, the strengthening of Jim Crow and the increase in race riots that follow the war. I'll ask more about that in a moment, but I also want to ask, when it did not work out as hoped for, what was the response of the African American community, particularly among the elites who had hoped for change?
Right. Well, there's clearly a sense of frustration and a desire on the part of many Black intellectuals, Black social and political leaders, to try and make sense of this moment and what happened. And I would argue that instead of a kind of retrenchment, there's a renewed commitment on the part of many African American leaders to continue the fight for African American citizenship and civil rights. I think W.B. Du Bois articulated it most poignantly in his famous post-war essay, Returning Soldiers, you know, declaring that, you know, we return from war, we return fighting. And that spirit in some ways embodied the post-war period for many African American civil rights activists and leaders, male and female, both North and South, in trying to obviously survive, you know, the maelstrom of the post-war period, but to use it also as an opportunity to continue the struggles that they had initiated during the wartime period itself. So I think we see a groundwork being laid during World War I that continues throughout the interwar period and into World War II as well. For example, this was a significant moment for the NAACP and the expansion of what would become, you know, the preeminent civil rights organization in terms of its membership and its voice within national politics. You know, that really occurred during the war and post-war period. You also get the emergence of new voices, more radical Black nationalist, Pan-Africanist voices who are advocating for more radical visions of social and political change, both domestically and internationally. Right? So this lends, I think, into a more kind of dynamic period of Black intellectual and political activity, which was characterized as the New Negro Movement following the war.
Can you say a little more about the New Negro Movement, what that represents broadly in terms of a response both to wartime and post-war experiences of disappointment for many African Americans?
Yeah, well, I think it was informed by a combination of both the disappointment but also the hope and aspirations that I was that I was alluding to earlier. And I think we have to point directly to the war, and to the experiences of black soldiers in the war, and how kind of the combined ideological dynamics of the war and actual experiences of black soldiers, as well as civilians, in the war transformed the racial and political consciousness of African Americans, right, in sharpening how they viewed the relationship between race and democracy, how they approached their status in relationship to the nation, but also their status in relationship to a broader African diaspora as well. So the emergence of a whole range of different black and diasporic political voices, individuals, organizations such as the Universal Negro Improvement Association, led by Marcus Garvey, which I talk about in the book, really, I think, embody how the war kind of transformed the way that black people saw themselves in the post-war world, and tried to engage in various strategies to expand the boundaries of democracy in ways that quite frankly kind of challenged the status quo and challenged how the very notion of civil rights had been practiced prior to the war. Right? So it's a very important period.
I mean, do we see it as a period where the leadership of figures like W.E.B. Du Bois is called into question?
Absolutely. He took the stand during the war of advocating for black participation, black loyalty, and was very controversial in that regard. He infamously wrote the editorial Close Ranks, in which he implored his fellow black Americans to close ranks with our fellow white Americans, and we make no ordinary sacrifice, but we make it gladly and willingly with our eyes lifted to the hills. And this did not sit well with many African Americans who did not see the benefits in placing their demands for increased civil rights on hold during the duration of the war, right? Submerging their demands for equal rights within the restrictive nature of American nationalism and the exigencies of participation and loyalty and obligation in the war. So as a result, you have a number of more radical voices, such as Hubert Harrison, such as Philip Randolph, later Marcus Garvey, who are very critical of black leaders like Du Bois, and their criticisms resonate with many African Americans as well, particularly working class African Americans, who are likewise frustrated with kind of the tone and tenor and strategies that more quote unquote mainstream black leaders were promoting during the war. Right. So you get, I think, a broadening of the spectrum of black protests during the World War I era, which would obviously be very important in terms of thinking about kind of the larger historical nature of black protests and black protest thought throughout the duration of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is also influenced by the race riots of the early 1920s, such as in Chicago and Tulsa, et cetera. How are these events connected to the wartime experience?
Well, I think these the race riots that occurred really immediately after the armistice, and you had racial clashes that were taking place in France even before black soldiers began to come home. But they were, I think, a product of the fears, the anxieties on the part of many white Americans, and the hopes and aspirations of many black Americans. When kind of these opposing forces kind of clashed in various environments, whether we're talking about a Chicago, Washington, D.C., or a Tulsa in 1921, or even in local communities in the South, you have these explosions which took place, which were direct products of the war. The Chicago race riot, for example, was in many ways precipitated by the influx of black migrants from the South. Mm-hmm. This was the beginnings of the Great Migration, which would last until World War II. But during the World War I era, you have half a million African Americans who leave the South, migrate to cities like New York, Chicago, Detroit, other major northern and midwestern cities. So the urban landscape in a city like Chicago had been transformed by the presence of black migrants. This led to increased labor tensions. And when you add returning black soldiers to the mix, it really made for a very combustible combination. And this was, I think, translated in a number of different cities as well. Washington, D.C., you see a similar phenomenon, which took place in the race riot there. But you also see in many of these racial clashes, these mini race wars, we might aptly characterize them, the determination of African Americans and African American veterans in particular to defend themselves, to defend their communities, to refuse to submit to racial violence, right? And so the race riots that took place during the post-war period were in some ways qualitatively different because the kind of nature of black resistance and self-defense, I would argue, was much more vigorous. And a lot of that had to do with the return of African-American veterans to their communities and what they represented, what they symbolized.
Right. Well, this is clearly a change from prior incidents before the war.
Right.
Well, I wonder if it's also possible that this resistance plays into white fears about the returning veteran.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I talk about that in my book, just the fears that were generated around the specter of the returning black veteran in terms of an increased racial political consciousness of what this would mean for African Americans more broadly demanding their rights as citizens after the war. You also have very powerful sexual anxieties as well. The image of black soldiers as being ruined, so to speak, by their relations with French women in France, that they would return back to the United States thinking that sexual relations with white women were acceptable. So this kind of feeds into the racial violence that greets black veterans in the South upon their return to the United States. So you do have these different fears, myths surrounding black veterans, which, interestingly enough, some African American leaders, particularly in the South, associated with the Tuskegee Institute, went to great lengths to try and assuage, to kind of tell white Southerners that, look, black soldiers are going to return to their homes and they're going to be good citizens, they're going to go back to the farms, they're going to get jobs, you have nothing to worry about. There's, I think, a clear strategy behind that, which in some ways did not speak to the reality. The reality being that many African-American veterans did indeed return back to their homes transformed in terms of their racial and political consciousness and were not willing to submit to the types of racism that they had had endured before as well as during the war.
In the end, what would you say are the lessons from the First World War regarding the African-American community and the issue of race in the United States?
Well, I think it demonstrates just how intertwined the very notion of race has been historically with the very notion of democracy in American history, that the two have – have always been inextricable. And I think during moments of war, I think in a broader historical perspective, that really becomes illuminated, right? That very contentious, oftentimes explosive relationship between race and democracy, right? And we see that quite vividly during World War I because of how the war was framed by Woodrow Wilson as a war to make the world safer democracy, and how African Americans seized upon that ideal, seized upon that rhetoric and used it to their advantage, you know, to apply it to their everyday circumstances, and specifically apply it to the experiences or I should say the presence of black soldiers in the United States Army, and how black soldiers themselves internalized these different meanings of democracy to make sense of their own experience. So I would argue that in the big picture, right, this was a moment both domestically but also internationally as well, locally and globally, in which black people and peoples of African descent attempted to stake claim to a notion of democracy through the war and through military service that reflected their visions of equality and justice and freedom.
Great. We're nearly out of time, Chad, but I do have one last question. Where do you go from here? Can you say a few words about your next project?
The next project. The next project is going to be an offshoot of this current project. I'm interested in looking at W.B. Du Bois, someone who we talked about, and historical writings regarding World War I. He had aspirations to write a history of black participation in World War I, which he never completed, despite spending some 17 years working on it. And I'm interested in telling that story, just why what he saw as or envisioned as kind of the definitive historical study on World War I was never completed, and what this tells us about both the history but also the contentious memory of World War I, both from Du Bois's perspective and from the perspective of African American soldiers and veterans as well. So that's on the immediate horizon. more down the road, I might have some interest in doing some work on World War II, but we'll see what comes of that.
Well, that'll be great. Chad Williams, thank you for joining us today. I enjoyed our talk, and I'm looking forward to talking to you in the future about your next book. Take care. You've been listening to our interview with Chad Williams, author of Torchbearers of Democracy, African American Soldiers in the World War I Era. This is Bob Wintermute for New Books in Military History. Thank you for listening.